The following presentation was recorded in 1998 at the Faith Builders Workshops on Child Development. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
I'd like to have us think about some family issues as we start off this morning. Children at risk. Around 35,000 children age 4 and under die of hunger every day. That figure is just astounding. It's hard to believe. There are 100 million street children around the world. 1.5 million children are victims of AIDS. During their first year of life, 80% of infants regularly spend time being cared for by someone other than their mothers. For most babies, the daycare experience begins early, on the average at age 3.11 months, and involves a big block of time, average of 29 hours per week. Researchers were especially concerned to find that infants are typically cared for by so many different people during their first year. 33% had three or more different daycare providers before they reached their first birthday. And this is more inspirational in nature, thinking about what kind of parenting requires, a little bit of what Milo was talking about. Until her children discovered their wings, there was no purpose for their lives. Until they learned to soar, they would fail to understand the privilege it was to have been born an eagle. The push was the greatest gift she had to offer. It was her supreme act of love, and so, one by one, she pushed them. And they flew. I often think about when I enjoy teaching. And I often think of the verse in James 3 where it says, "My brothers, not many of you should be masters, or not many of you should be teachers, knowing that we who teach shall receive greater condemnation." I've often pondered, what does that verse mean? And you all are teachers as well. I want you to think about what it means for you. But to use a very present example, you know, I spent yesterday talking about how to be a good parent and a good teacher. And, you know, when I go home, my family isn't overly impressed with how much I know about parenting. What comes through to them is what I do. And so these statistics I read, those are also the result of people who are just sort of doing their own thing, following their own ways, not willing to sacrifice or commit to people, and especially their own families, the responsibilities God calls them to. Thinking about families, I still wrestle with it. It's a live issue with me, but why is it that we can say that if you have a family, nothing else matters as much as that does? We can pursue knowledge and fame and all those things with great energy and achieve significantly in those areas. But if we lose on the family side, we're in trouble. And in the end, I had a professor in college who told me here a year or so ago that his one daughter was moving in with them, her and her two daughters, because her husband, who was in the Air Force, said that he needed more time to do what he was doing in the Air Force. He flies fighter planes. And in order to be one of the best, it just requires that much time. He didn't feel, and doesn't this sound good? He just didn't feel he could do justice to her. And so he felt it'd be better if they would just divorce and he could get more time to fly. And I'm thinking, what a fool. I mean, at 65, who's going to care about how well when he's 65, who in his life is going to honor him for his achievements in flying? But he's going to sit on the back porch of some nursing home, rocking himself to death. And he'll be alone. But we forget those things when we're young and have energy and want to achieve. Let me read you a little story, a little article, not really a story. It was December in California, and we had flown in from Texas to visit our families for the holidays. The days between our arrival and Christmas Eve brimmed with a flurry of last-minute activities. One evening, we all hustled into the car to drive to a Christmas party at the home of family friends. We were a little behind schedule because my mom, sister, and I had gotten home late after spending a long day writing checks, signing charge slips, and bringing hysterical grins of joy to the faces of local merchants at the nearby mall. My mom looked across the front seat at my dad and said, "Whew, what a busy day. I feel like I haven't seen you in a week." My dad grunted, checked the rearview mirror, and changed lanes at something approximating the speed of light. My mom reached over and twirled a lock of my dad's hair around her finger. "I know. Let's just look at each other for just a minute, in the eyes." My dad responded this time. He groaned, "Honey, I'm driving." 10 seconds. 5. "I haven't seen you all day. I need to look into your eyes. Are you ready?" He shook his head. "I can't look right now. We'll have a wreck." At the next light. At the speed we were traveling, we hit the next red light in no time, and sure enough, holding hands across the front seat, my parents turned and gazed into each other's eyes. "Hi," my mom said. "Hi," my dad said warmly back. Then the light changed. The gas pedal hit the floor and the race was on again. Nothing had changed, and yet everything had changed. Most of all, I was silently moved by what I had witnessed, a small harbor of reconnection in a raging hurricane of activity and distraction. I tell you, in our schools, we talked Sunday, again, at the colloquy about how schools, and it was Melvin that talked about this, schools can be a means of a platform in our communities for recharging our vision. And I there's something in me that responds strongly to that vision. And yet on the other side, I want to remember that the school is more artificial in nature than the home. The home was part of creation. We don't read anything about schools right off. I think it's very legitimate and important and necessary. But don't ever forget that the home was first. And whether you are in a marriage or whether you are teaching children and working with families, don't ever forget the importance of family and do all you can. Some of you have been mentioned to me. How do you speak into marriages and families when you're only, 18, 20, 25? It's a good question. I ask the same question. I still feel that way. And I'm close to 35. But all I can say is that don't underestimate your influence. Pray about it. God will give you opportunities. And it's amazing how someone in a marriage 10, 15, 20 years, who's tired, has perhaps lost a little bit of that first love, that vision, how much they can be encouraged by you just giving your own appreciation for seeing a good marriage, a good family, and encouraging them, telling them to keep on, that it's worth the fight, it's worth the race. Let me read you a couple statistics here on divorce. The high price of amicable divorces. The phrase amicable divorce suggests that couples can mutually agree to part ways nicely without causing serious emotional damage to their children. However, a new 15-year study entitled A Generation at Risk, Growing Up in an Era of Family Upheaval, suggests otherwise. The study found that approximately 2/3 of divorces occur in marriages in which partners are simply bored with each other. Marriage is not marked by high levels of conflict. Though many marriages are dissolved amicably as far as the husband and wife are concerned, the children of these in broken families still pay for their parents' selfishness. As adults, children of each of such divorces are unhappier, experience more psychological problems, are less connected to other family members, and suffer poor marriages themselves. Another statistic now on divorce benefiting a high conflict family, in contrast to an amicable divorce. In his recent book, A Generation at Risk, University of Nebraska sociologist Paul Amato published the results of almost two decades of research on the effects of divorce on children. Amato's research indicates that the way divorce affects a child is directly related to the level of conflict in the parent's marriage before the divorce. In divorces between high conflict partners, children fared as well as children who grew up in stable families. Children of low conflict divorces, however, suffered from a lack of trust that created other psychological problems. These children are particularly unhappy and have more difficulty developing relationships, says Amato. The dissolution of a home that they thought was stable is an unwelcome and disturbing event in the lives of these offspring. So you understand what he's saying there. He's saying that if there wasn't much conflict, and then suddenly there's this divorce, it's just, you can imagine the betrayal that is felt at that point. Whereas if there's a high amount of conflict, perhaps even physical abuse, the divorce comes as a relief. And they're able to put that conflict behind them and go on. Let me read you a little bit about spanking. We've heard a lot in the last 20 years about spanking and the fact that it's such a terrible thing. Well, in U.S. News, April of this year, there was an article, and here's a summary of it. If you've been going into hiding to spank your children, you can come out now. Evidence now shows that temperate spanking, used to be they wouldn't even allow that as a category, but now it is. Temperate spanking won't turn little Susie into a violent adult, but usually helps positively shape her behavior. With the rise of pop psychology and the breakdown of the extended family came the anti-spanking philosophies, furthered by such child-rearing experts as Benjamin Spock. These new approaches encourage child-centered families. While parents sought to reason children out of bad behavior, spanking became linked with low self-esteem and aggression. Again, remember Piaget's statement that we talked about earlier this week, that children before the age of 5, 8 years old, they don't have great reasoning capacities. They're much more concrete. These people knew that, but they still espoused it based on theories like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Interestingly, however, parents haven't been quick to entirely eliminate spanking from their arsenal of disciplines. As recently as 1997, 65% of Americans approved of spanking. Not down much from 74% in 1946. Those who felt guilty about spanking haven't been helped by researchers like Murray Strauss and Erwin Hyman. Strauss consigns spanking victims to a problematic future of juvenile delinquency, depression, sexual problems, and lower job and earning prospects. Hyman wishes to outlaw spankings, yet when spanking was outlawed in Sweden, child abuse increased 400% in 10 years. Monitoring difficulties have flawed studies like Strauss and given more credence to a longer-term study. Using data that tracked over 1,100 children for 5 years, psychologist Marjorie Gounod found that 4 to 7-year-olds who were spanked got in fewer fights at school. An analysis of the best 35 studies failed to find any convincing evidence that non-abusive spanking, as typically used by parents, damaged children. Now that's entirely different language, as typically used by parents. 10 years ago, that was all mocked and cried down as that there is no such thing. Any spanking was abuse. In fact, it showed that this non-abusive spanking was more beneficial than most other approaches to discipline. As psychologists rewrite spanking rules, they're also cautioning parents that spanking should be done with a flat hand on the child's rear and be incorporated with other disciplinary measures like timeouts. Well, I'm glad some people... You see what's happening here. Modern man, because they have such great respect for research, the scientific method, they're finally, okay, it's taken a long time, but the research is showing it, proving it out. So perhaps a few are willing to respect that. It's unfortunate that that's what it takes. That's why the scientific method alone is inadequate for making your decisions. I have just a couple thoughts here in conclusion on character development that I want to share with you. How is conviction developed? Of course, we see conviction growing out of character training. Number one, convictions are usually modeled by the significant people in our lives. And so just think about the people that you have respected, that you have had a strong or even somewhat strong relationship with. Someone you have admired, someone who has been there enough in your life that you've been able to see who they are and to experience in your own life in a relational, experiential way what they believe. It's those people that influence you significantly in what you believe. Just take, for example, your decision to stay in your particular church in light of all the options, even if you want to remain a fairly conservative Mennonite. There are still various options. But I would venture to say that much of what keeps you there is the fact that significant people in your life have lived in an honest way, have said, this is what I believe, this is what I think is true, this is what I think is the best way. There may be other ways, but this is, for me, this is what I think God calls me to. And here's where the Lord put me, and I'm going to stay here. And you're going to look at all that, and you're going to say, you know, I think that's what I believe. And I want to just tell you that that is right. I think that is correct. A biblical Christian way to make decisions about my own convictions. Remember what Proverbs says. Listen to your father and mother's instruction. It will be life to you. Life to you. So usually it's fathers and mothers, extended family, community. It could include songs you've heard ever since you were little. It could include stories. We'll talk more about stories here in a minute. But Gordon MacDonald, from which I pulled this little list here, he says that what a child sees and hears in those significant lives goes on to be the first formation of convictions and character patterns at the base of his or her experience. No wonder Jesus said that it'd be better if a millstone were hung around your neck and you were dropped in the sea if you offend one of these little ones. Number two, the stories we hear are a source of conviction. It's from these stories that we take in the dominant character traits and qualities of our heroes. And I just remember in my own life, my first second grade teacher was Ruth Emsweiler. If you know the song, Tender Love of Jesus. Okay, she wrote that song. And she was my first and second grade teacher in Elida, Ohio. Well, a few things I remember in first, second grade, but one thing I do remember is all the missionary stories she would read to us. And those still stick with me. I grew up thinking that Harold Fly in Ontario, who started Northern Light programs, it's now Impact North. But I grew up thinking he was a mighty man of God. And I think he was a very motivated, godly man. And yet a lot of it came from the stories that she would read and talk. And I grew up thinking everybody probably knows Harold Fly, and you may not even know who that is by now. But those stories stuck with me. Stories about angels. She told a story about how his wife would always be afraid when he would take off and fly. You know, you land on lakes up there and you take off on lakes. And she would always be so fearful. You're flying over the unmarked landscape of the north there, and it's just woods and lakes is all it is. And you fly by sight. And she'd always be so fearful. And one day as he was taking off and she was praying and feeling the normal, the usual fear, she saw an angel under each wing of that plane. The Lord allowed her to see that. And that story just always stuck with me. I thought of it myself when I get in a plane and fly. And so those stories make significant impacts. I remember my dad talking about different men he admired. And I thought, I grew up thinking these men were just wonderful. When I got to know them as I got older, I thought, well, these are just normal guys. But I thought they were incredible men just because I heard them, heard people talking about them in ways that increased my admiration. We could talk about a lot of other things here. Stories you hear in Bible school, Sunday school, your Christian school, books. Books that I read. I still operate in many ways out of the stories and images and character qualities that I've read in books like Chronicles of Narnia and The Greatest Story Ever Told, The Hobbit, biographies like Robert Sheffy, Moody, other men like that, Daniel Boone, pioneers, missionaries, Robin Hood, Robinson Crusoe. All those stories have qualities that stick with us. And it adds to I want to call it, it's not a museum, but it's a picture gallery. And when you're in different situations, those pictures will come to your mind. And you know how other great men of character responded in similar situations. And there's something there within you that gives you the capacity to respond the same way that those people did. And I think stories are tremendously powerful in developing character and conviction. Number three, as we get older, it's possible to learn convictions through abstract principles. One of the things we talk about in life are what McDonald calls disruptive moments. Disruptive moments. And for me, one of them in my family was my brother, who was number seven in the family. I'm number one. He was number seven. Was born mentally handicapped, moderately to severely handicapped. And I remember a number of things during that time. I remember how different he was as a baby, was not at all normal in growth and behavior. And all those things, as I watched my mom holding him and crying, looking at him and crying over him, and my parents going to the hospital, all those things, it was disruptive. It was different. And so that influenced the way I look at people today who are handicapped. And I feel, rather than feeling a lot of aversion or discomfort, I feel quite comfortable around people who are not normal. And it's those disruptive moments, those times when we learn things the hard way, that develop conviction. And I react strongly to when I see people ridiculing or mocking or taking advantage of someone who is not as able to respond. There's something that rises up within me in defense. And I believe largely out of experiencing that in my own life. This can also be something like a college professor I had, a very fine lady I was a music major, and she was my theory teacher for a couple years, my piano teacher. One of the things about her, she required so many hours of practice for an A in piano. Okay, well, that requires discipline and a level that I didn't quite have, or a level of motivation I wasn't able to manufacture. So I did really well. They always told me I did really well. For no more practice than I put in, they said, you practice well, but it's not enough. Okay, well, so I never got more than a C in piano any time. And she said, the hours I practice, they're average. If you want to be average, then you'll get a C, okay? Well, I could never talk her out of a bad grade. You know, I did my best. But she never let me talk her out of a grade like that. But I always felt, even in that, I always felt she had a special place in her heart for me. In fact, we still correspond some. And I'm sure it wasn't just me, but that's just the kind of teacher she was. And the lesson I learned there was that some things in life are not replaced by hard work and discipline. Well, convictions also emerge from the Christian's ultimate source literature, the Bible. Number of stories here we could give, and I think we've experienced this, but the Bible itself becomes a teacher. Ezra just simply read out of the law one whole forenoon. And then there were men that would try to explain it. And MacDonald just points out that when someone comes to Scripture, there is always the potential of a supernatural event taking place. When you and I come to Scripture, the potential is supernatural. It's no ordinary piece of literature. Hebrews 4:12, the Word of God is quick and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, joints and marrow, and a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. I'd like to think now a little about learning theory. How does learning take place? And you may have heard the story of the boy and his father who are out chopping wood one bright, sunny, crisp winter morning. And the father's chopping wood and the little boy's looking around, just taking it all in and enjoying being out there with dad. And he says, Dad, why are clouds white? Dad, he's chopping away. After a minute, he stops. Says, "Oh," he says, "Well, son," he said, "it's just because that's the way God made it." Keeps chopping wood. Pretty soon, the little boy says, "Dad, why is the sky blue?" Dad keeps chopping wood, and he says, "Well, son, I guess that's just the way God made it." Son's quiet for a while, and he asks him, he says, Dad, you don't like when I ask questions, do you?" And his dad says, "Oh, no, son, I don't mind at all. That's the way you learn." That's the way you learn. Isn't that how we are sometimes? I'm going to present a number of specifics, and you may have heard of the terms inductive and deductive reasoning. Inductive is really the way that the scientific method works. You study and observe details and specifics, and then out of that study of specifics, you draw some general conclusions, or you make some more fundamental statement about those specifics. Deductive reasoning takes a general statement and applies it to many specific things. So if we were to depict this visually, this is inductive. We put all kinds of data in here, and then we come out with I'm just going to call it a fundamental principle that we can say is true about all of those specifics. All right, that's inductive. Deductive takes that fundamental principle. My artwork isn't going to be very good here. And applies it to many specific things. All right, well, I'm going to take you inductively this way today. And we're going to talk about a number of things in the way we learn, and then in the first part of tomorrow morning, I want to share with you a few basics as to what makes it all possible from a biblical perspective. We have learning, we talk about domains. If you remember, we've talked about cognitive development, affective development, and physical and motor development, all those areas. Well, when it comes to learning, then we want to take and we want to use or access as many of those areas as we can in teaching. So when it comes to helping children learn, we want to teach through the cognitive domain. We call them domains, okay? So the cognitive domain has to do with thinking. And I want to address that one first. It has to do with the area of knowing. The cognitive domain has to do with knowing. And a man by the name of Benjamin Bloom in Chicago came up with these a number of years ago. And in fact, it's much of his thinking, I'll just tell you this, it's much of his thinking that has given us outcome-based education, because he applied his thinking not only to the cognitive but also to the affective, which has to do with feeling and relationships. And his schools emphasize mastery learning. In fact, it's if you have individualized classrooms, the whole idea of requiring a certain grade before you can go on to the next pace or book, the whole idea is there that you master the material before you're allowed to go on. Okay, we call that mastery learning. That comes from Benjamin Bloom. And so we have used his thinking in a number of areas. However, his philosophy as a whole just failed miserably. I mean, his curriculum was thrown out of Chicago schools here several years ago as a miserable failure. And yet he's done some good thinking in a conceptual way as to how learning takes place. And so we can learn from what he has done in this area. But I don't believe, I should just say this, I don't believe this answers the question of motivation. All right, so we're talking about how it happens as it's happening. But we're not talking about motivation. What makes a learner willing to learn? Or what makes him want to learn? We're just talking about what happens when he learns. We'll talk about what's behind it tomorrow. Okay, so Bloom said that there were, you'll see a different one, six or seven. I'm going to say six, although you see seven here. I want to combine two here. I'm going to call that two and three you can put under comprehension. All right? So he said that we have the very basic level is knowledge, or what we can memorize. Facts, basic facts. Student recalls or recognizes information. Then we have comprehension, where the student is able to either translate it or interpret it. And we have application, where the student solves a lifelike problem that requires identification of the issue and selection of appropriate generalizations and skills. Then analysis, then synthesis, and then evaluation. Now, we may think, and here's the goal, as a teacher, you want to take your student from the first level of learning and thinking, the knowledge level, to the higher levels of thinking like analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. Now, this is more difficult than we might think. Today, there's been a lot of debate about how people learn. And the big one of the big pushes in outcome-based education, which is often called OBE, has been that we need to teach process, not content. Process and content are the two big words there. Well, process is how people learn and think. Content is what they learn. And so the idea is that knowledge is always changing. Okay, that's a humanistic premise grows out of evolutionary thinking, that we're always developing, changing. Since knowledge is always changing, truth is not absolute. Therefore, it's more important to teach people how to learn than to teach them what to learn, because what they need to learn may change over time. Okay, and we might raise our eyebrows at that, but that's what they really believe. Okay, so they have emphasized process over content. Well, that's a lot of the philosophy that this grew out of. However, utilizing this thinking in our classrooms, we can benefit tremendously. Let's just think about knowledge. 2 + 2 = 4. Beethoven wrote the 9th symphony, and I can listen to it and recognize a melody. Longfellow is an important writer, and he wrote whatever composition you want to mention there. Facts, knowledge, okay? You may know quite a bit about Beethoven's 9th. You may be able to recognize the melody. You may be able to know how long it takes to perform it. You may be able to say why it was unique as a symphony. But you have not gone on to comprehension or application or analysis unless you can begin to compare it to his 7th symphony or to Mozart's symphonies or to Haydn's symphonies or to whoever. You can know a lot about Beethoven's 9th and never get off the first level. All right? You can know a lot of math facts, and I Melvin was telling me, he was talking to you about this yesterday a little bit. We're good on this level here. We do pretty well on this, but we often don't push up into these levels. Now, let's just look at some words. And let me just give you another definition here for knowledge. I gave you that. I told it's facts or recall. Comprehension is you're able to explain it in words. That's a simple definition of comprehension. You're able to explain it in words. And I might add in your own words. Application is the ability to use information. Okay? So I learned all this math. Can I go over here now and as a cashier or as an accountant or as a accounts receivable department person, can I take my math and put it to work? Analysis, the ability to break things down into parts. Okay, so I know a little Beethoven's 9th. Can I take it now and say, okay, from this measure is the first theme. From this measure to this measure, he introduces a subordinate theme. And here's the first section. Here's the first, he modulates to this key. I mean, I can begin to break it down. Okay? That's analysis. Synthesis, ability to take what was learned over time and put it down in your own unique way. Take what is learned over time and put it down in your own unique way. That's synthesis. Take what was learned over time and put it down in your own unique way. An evaluation, then, is the ability to judge something, the ability to judge something on a set of criteria, on a set of criteria. Well, let's look at some words that we can use. Let's put some action words to Bloom's taxonomy here. This time we have them across the top. And if you want to write objectives as a teacher and you want to begin to move into some of these higher levels of learning, by the way, let me emphasize, you can't bypass number one. Abeka, how many of you use Abeka curriculum? Okay. Have you read their pamphlet on thinking skills? Have you read that? Okay. They address this debate, process content debate. And they talk about the fact that they're big on rote memory. And if you teach Abeka, you know that. Rote memory is huge. Their whole argument for that is that you can't think without facts. How can you think about something if you don't know anything about it? That's their whole argument. Okay? Now, there's a lot of truth to that. You have to be able to think, to know something about it, to begin to comprehend it, to apply it, to analyze it, to determine whether it's good or bad. You need to know something about it. So this is important. It's just we need to move on into these areas. We need to push a little bit, especially in the upper grades. Okay, so here's some words for the knowledge. Count, define, describe, draw, identify. And you can read them there. Comprehension. Well, can you associate? Can you compute? Can you convert? Defend, discuss, distinguish between. Estimate, explain. And then when we talk about application, we can add, we can apply, we can calculate, we can change, we can classify. If you know the definitions, you know how to identify things. If you can identify something, then you can begin to classify it. Demonstrate, discover, examine, modify, use. Well, then we come to analysis, analyze, arrange, break down, combine, design, develop, differentiate, outline. We can analyze it, take it apart, synthesize, put it back together, categorize, combine, compile, create, design, explain. Some of these come in several categories here. And then the evaluation side, where we can appraise something, we can assess it, we can criticize it, critique it, grade it, judge it, measure it, test it, support it, all those things. So when you prepare a lesson, I keep one of these in front of me all the time in my office somewhere. So that when I'm preparing a lesson, I can look on that sheet and say, okay, how am I doing? I want to for sure get this. And just by way of experience here, when I began to learn all these things, I had primarily felt like I learned a lot in this area in my school. And so I thought this was fantastic stuff. And when I started teaching, I really pushed this side of it. But then I began to realize that some of my students weren't doing so hot over here. Okay? And so I was influenced as well by the process content debate. It's important to have the knowledge. They need that first. Then you need to make sure that you begin to push over to this other side as well. Well, let's look another way to look at critical thinking. It's a term that you'll hear a lot. It's critical thinking. Here we have two columns. Ordinary thinking, critical thinking, and reasoning. Okay, now this is a little different than Bloom's category. But what they call ordinary, they would, I think a better word for that would be poor thinking. Or, I don't want to say narrow, but inadequate thinking perhaps. We do this kind of thing, and it may be okay in some things, but it's not adequate if we want to make good decisions. Okay, guessing, preferring. Opposing guessing is estimating. Sometimes we say, well, I made an educated guess. All right, that means you were estimating. Preferring, evaluating, grouping, classifying, believing, assuming. Say, well, it appears, I'm going to assume that this is true. That's more guarded approach than saying, I believe it. Okay, that's the way it is. Infer logically, associating concepts, grasping principles, noting relationships, noting relationships among other relationships. Okay? There's more to see than what we see, someone has said. There's always more to see than what we see. And it's very easy to look at something, take in what's obvious, and say, well, this must be the situation, therefore this is the problem, therefore this is the solution. Okay, be careful that we don't do that too quickly. Noting relationships, supposing or hypothesizing. If you hypothesize, then you are going to test it. Offering opinions without reasons, offering opinions with reasons, making judgments without criteria, making judgments with criteria. Ordinary versus critical thinking. We'll look at some brain theory and function here in a few minutes. But I want to talk a little bit about thinking and how we think. I think I mentioned the other morning that Tanya, this lady who is in the hospital with serious brain injury from the accident, was a divergent thinker. She didn't have typical thought patterns. She always surprised me, at least, with some of her thinking patterns and the conclusions she drew. And she was a stimulating person to talk to. But we have two different kinds of thinking. I'm going to call this the convergent thinking. Here, everything is coming in this way. And let me give you some words. People that think convergently, or this kind of thinking, they want right answers. They want right answers. They are very quick to distinguish right from wrong. They think in terms of absolutes. They think in terms of order and predictability. All right, the convergent thinker. So notice all these things come from without. We talked about revelation as a way of knowing. That's how we know there are absolutes. And so we have right answers coming in from without. This is the person here and their way of thinking. We have right and wrong. We have absolutes. We have order, predictability. All those things are descriptions of convergent thinking. And is that bad? Is that incorrect? No, it's not. We've talked about the need for revelation. There are some weaknesses to this, however. Some weaknesses to this is that it can be, isn't always, but it can be simplistic. In other words, it may not be the whole picture. It can be misleading. This kind of person often thinks all the questions are answered. Okay? All the questions are answered, and therefore the person can be gullible at times. Okay, so those are some weaknesses to convergent thinking that we do well to remember. Well, on the other side, then, we have what we call divergent thinking. And it's this kind of thinking that starts in the middle and works its way out. Okay? Starts in the middle and works its way out. And here, this person's looking out this way. All right? We call it divergent thinking. And the characteristics of this kind of thinking are that they are original. In other words, hey, I thought of something. Would this work? And they'll just pop out this idea. Say, well, where'd you come with that? Oh, I don't know. I was just thinking about that. Or they'll have non-original ways of doing things. Very creative. Problem solving. They love to solve problems because they take and they say, well, let's look at this problem. And yes, they'll know this is true, this is right, there's some absolutes involved here, but let's think about this creatively. And so they'll be original. And there'll be a fair amount of independence. This person will demonstrate a fair amount of independence. Let me just give an example. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, one of the things that made him an important leader in terms of demonstrating leadership is that when there was a problem or a crisis, when there was a crisis, he looked within and he said, okay, what needs to happen here? And out of his own principles of what he believed was right, out of what he believed to be true about people and life, he would respond. And what he did was an expression of who he was. Okay? If you've kept up with the news at all, you've read different articles how President Clinton is just the opposite. Okay? When there's a problem, he wants 20 people around him to work to find out the data, research the problem, present possible solutions. And also, while you're at it, take about 5 or 10 polls, okay? See, people are thinking out there. And then based on that, we'll make a decision, okay? So you don't have the sense at all that there are some internal absolutes with Mr. Clinton, okay? Well, there's some moral issues involved in that discussion and some philosophical ones as well. But in some ways, it demonstrates the contrast between convergent and divergent thinking. The weaknesses in the divergent thinking are that it can be relativistic. Okay, if you start inside and you don't take into account absolutes, right and wrong, you can end up relativistic and begin to compromise on absolutes. It can be seen as tentative. Tentative. That's just my idea. You know, you think it'll work? I mean, just thought about it. It can be complicating. These people try to take in the big picture, and they try to think about all the relationships, and they see this, they see that. And they don't think in terms of clear standards of right and wrong, but they look at relationships between things, and so they tend to draw in a lot of different relationships, which tends to make the problem complicated, and perhaps more complicated than it needs to be, given absolutes. Other weaknesses: the person will accept nothing from outside of himself. Person will accept nothing is a weakness of divergent thinking. Okay, well, that's cognitive domain. Thinking and learning cognitively. Let's look at the affective domain in learning. Affective domain. Here we look at feelings, emotions, attitudes, and values. When you listen to a good speaker, many times, if he's giving a list of principles, those can be outstanding principles, but if he does not tell you any stories, if he doesn't give any personal illustrations or examples, we'll find it to be what some people call pretty brainy or pretty theoretical, or we'll feel like it's not very practical. Well, when you feel that way, what has happened is that you have not felt your feelings and emotions stirred. You haven't heard from the standpoint of feeling and attitude and emotion. It's just kind of cold facts. But the affective domain has to do with feelings, emotions, attitudes, and values. Howard Hendricks says that as a teacher, you need to massage the emotions of your students. All right? Help them feel. He puts these three areas: something I know, something I feel, and then something I do. I'll mention that again later. Okay, so the affective domain, receiving, responding. And here we're going from first level learning to higher level learning again. First of all, you receive. You hear the story. You hear it. Well, then the next level would be responding in some way. The third one would be valuing. Valuing what you heard. Either you don't like it or you do like it, or you determine to hang on to it, to keep it, to remember it. And then you organize it. Level four, bringing together a series of values. You put that value you learned alongside some of the values you've already had in place. And then number five, characterization by a value or a value complex. In other words, it becomes a controlling factor in one's life. A controlling factor in one's life. John Maxwell tells a story, said that one of the principles that guides his life is that you pay now and you play later. He says it's a very simple principle. You pay now and you play later. If you decide to play now and pay later, you always pay more later than what you would if you'd pay on the front end. And he said the way that he learned that growing up was that he had a certain number of chores to do every week in their family, in their household. And his father always told him, John, it's very simple. The basement needs to be cleaned out this week. Now, you can do it anytime you want this week. I'm going to give you that freedom. But let me tell you something. Saturday morning, we're going on a family outing. If that basement's not done, you're staying home. Okay? It's very simple. You pay now, play later. He said it only took about one time to watch the family pull out of the drive without me to remember that I wanted to get that done. Now, that became a characterization. Okay? He learned something. In information, you learn something in emotions and attitudes, values, became a controlling factor in his life. That's the affective domain. And this is really, if you hear about outcome-based education, that's really what they have pushed. They have said, we need to get people to feel. And if you, again, remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the top of that pyramid, that hierarchy, is self-actualization, okay? The full expression of the human person. That's what they want. Well, the full expression is that they need to feel. They need to feel passion and energy and pleasure, all those things. Feeling is huge. And if truth and absolutes are always changing, well, why major on that? Why not feel good? Why not experience life with passion and energy? Okay, well, there's a lot of truth to that. I love to feel passion and energy about things. But that's not the whole. All right? So OBE is what has pushed affective learning. And they've left out the content and have emphasized feelings. Doesn't mean that it's of no value. We do. It requires some affective domain learning. But it is not where we start or stop. And then we have the psychomotor domain. Other word for physical and motor skills. And the first level here is perception. Perception. When I perceive something, it enters into my physical experience. And then, of course, it affects my set. And I'm going to talk about that more tomorrow. But my set, or my mental readiness. My set. And then I have a guided response. The teacher will show me something and I can repeat it. All right? They show me something and I repeat it. And an example would be if I were to lecture on maintenance and repair of 10-speed bicycles. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, and I come up here and I don't have a single overhead, and we're here in this nice chapel and this carpet and clean tables, and I give you a 1-hour lecture on how to take care of a 10-speed bike. How much would you learn, actually take out the door with you to be able to put to work on your own bike? Now, some of you might really like that approach. We'll talk about learning styles this morning later on. Some of you might like that approach, although I'm going to tell you, you're not going to be the best mechanic at 10-speed bikes if you like that approach. Well, or I could bring in a great set of diagrams on my overhead and point out all the intricacies of 10-speed bikes on diagrams on my overhead. Well, that'd be a lot better. You could see it. But I could also have you, I could also bring in a 10-speed bike, get a big table up here, set it up here, and as I talk about it, I point out and I demonstrate all those things. Or I could have you come up, and while I talk about it, I show you and help you do. All right? Well, here is what we're talking about right there. I get you involved in the process. Number four is mechanism. It becomes part of you. You do it without being told. Now you're taking what you know and you're doing it without being told. Number five is what we call complex overt response. And that's teacher speak, maybe, or education speak for the fact that you're demonstrating that you can pull together different areas of knowledge and experience and ability and do something. Adaptation is where you can take what I told you about 10-speed bikes and what I showed you, and you can say, you know, I'm working on a unicycle over here. I wonder if I could do something with my unicycle. I don't know much about that, but some of you ride unicycles around here. They only have one speed, isn't that right? You don't have 10-speed unicycles. But maybe you could make a 10-speed unicycle. I don't know. You could improve on it. And number seven is origination. You take what you know and you might invent something completely different, but because of what you know about 10-speed bikes, you're able to take that knowledge as well as other things that you know and put it together and create something new. Well, the whole area of brain study has in recent years become a fascinating study. And it's been interesting now. I was trying to figure out a way I could put this on overhead for you, but I wasn't able to figure it out. But I had a diagram pulled out of a news magazine that showed the brain scan of a boy who was in a Romanian orphanage soon after birth. And received very little care, very little personal attention and love and affection. And a boy who grew up in a normal family. And it was amazing. They were talking about brain development and language development and skill and emotional capacity. And it was interesting that the brain, actually the size of the brain the temporal lobes, where much of this resides in the brain, the size of the brain was noticeably smaller in that Romanian boy than what it was in the brain of the normal person. And so the theory is that all the little things, and there's numerous articles in magazines, if you keep an eye out for them, you'll see this periodically, where all the little things that we do with babies, you know, peekaboo, hi, throw them up in the air and wiggle and, you know, all the little things we do. Interaction. We're wanting response, and we want this response, and we're constantly stimulating them to respond. That whole process is actually affecting and influencing all the connections and the growth and development of the brain. And that's the exciting thing. Now, we don't even have to know that in order for it to happen if we have healthy families. But it does influence what we think about teaching and learning, how people learn. And so there's been a lot of study done on right brain, left brain tendencies. Now, one of the amazing things is that people, for instance, if you've read, I can't remember the title of the book now, but the brain surgeon who writes about excellence, I can't remember his name. How many have read that book? You know what I'm talking about? He's taken, anyone know the title? Gifted Hands. What's his name?
Ben Carson.
Ben Carson, yes. All right. And of course, you've read how he's removed actual, you know, the whole hemisphere, one side or the other, if you have brain tumor or something, remove that from a person, and they're still able to live and function as whole persons. And it's a fascinating study. However, the theory is that you have a dominant side on the brain. And so people learn differently. And it's out of this whole study that we look at learning styles, right brain, left brain, right hemisphere, left hemisphere functions. At the top of the list here, you'll see these words we were talking about: convergent and divergent thinking. The left brain is associated with the more logical side. Intellectual, deductive, rational, thinks vertically, absolutes, right and wrong. Discrete, abstract, realistic, directed, differential, sequential, all these words. Right side is divergent, intuitive. You ask somebody that thinks right brain, how do you know that? Well, I don't know, I just think that's the way it is, okay? Intuitive. And sometimes as men, we criticize or poke fun at ladies because they're much more intuitive than men as a rule. There is a reason for that, you know. How many of you heard about that? Well, let me tell you. I hate to tell you guys, but it is actually true that men are brain damaged, okay? Here, late in the pregnancy, a chemical reaction occurs in which a fluid, which is, as I understand it, now you better check me. I haven't read up on this lately, but I've seen the research on it, where there's actually a chemical that coats the brain of the male baby. And what it does, it stops as many connections, stops the development of connections between right and left side. For female babies, this does not happen. And so there are more neural connections between right and left side in females than there are in men. This is what enables women to think much more globally, we call it, rather than being as logical, which for men, it means we think much more on the left side. We're more logical, rational, and of course, because we think we're normal, we think that's the best way. We're much more tended to think in logical terms. It's what enables a mom, really, this global ability is what enables a mom to be talking on the phone, mixing cookies, and keeping track of a little two-year-old Johnny in the living room all at one time. Is your mom, I mean, gentlemen, you think about it, is your mom or your wife ever kidded you about having a one-track mind? You can't talk and work at the same time? That's true of me. If I want to have a good chat, I'll stop working and I'll talk. and then I'll have a good chat, and then I'll start working again. Can't stand it when my wife wants to keep working. I said, come on, you're not even, you know, you're not talking. And so this has to do with the number of connections. For men, they say it's more like we have to go up the ladder, across the wall, and down the other side to use the right side of the brain. For ladies, there's all these connections that just, it all happens all at once. It's too bad, but I guess it's supposed to be that way. It does enable us, though. Think about it, gentlemen. It enables us to put aside feelings more often, doesn't it? We put aside feelings and we see things more in terms of what needs to be done, perhaps, more in terms of goals, absolutes, right and wrong, maybe the big picture. What we see, when I say the big picture, I mean in terms of absolutes, right and wrong, what needs to be done. Whereas women are going to think much more relationally. And you'll do well, gentlemen, if you consult your wife regularly on your relationship. It's what makes men, when they, if you ask them to rate their marriage, they'll say, oh, I'm on a scale of 1 to 10. No, I'd say that's a 7. And the wife will say, oh, I was going to say more like a 3 or 4. You know? So this intuitive thinking and relational, look at all these things over here on the right. Intuitive, it's horizontal instead of vertical. In other words, there's much more of this awareness, what's going on around them relationally. It's more continuous. For men, it's a little bit like a fishing tackle box. When we're doing one thing, we pull out the fish, the lure we need to do this one thing. When you're fishing bass. I'm not a good fisherman, but this is a good example. I've fished with people a number of times that are good fishermen. You pull out this for this certain location and fish. You go over here and you pull out another one. For ladies, it's more like you got to wade into the river. Okay, life is a continuous flow, and you got to get in there and get right in the river and participate relationally. Well, it's continuous. That's what I'm talking about there. It's more holistic, a big word that you'll hear a lot. We need to think holistically. It's also more subjective. That's why men sometimes get frustrated or at least poke fun at the way ladies think, because it seems subjective. Well, how's come you say that? I mean, how do you know that? You're just talking out of your own experience. Don't you know this is true? And we tend to be more objective. Well, there are men that are much more right-brained than others. And we talk about the cold, rational thinker who doesn't appear to have any feelings, you know. Very left brain. Well, there are other men that are very relational, but still not to the extent that many women. And there are women then that are much more left brain than right brain. But as a whole, secular research points out that there are actually differences between men and women in the way they think and in the actual brain structure. That's the interesting thing. Well, let's put some words to this, some action words to left brain, right brain. Analyzes, uses logic, aware of time, deals with events in sequence, reduces to parts. Okay, that's what we tend to do. We want to take it apart, understand it. Whereas the right brain responds to intuition, uses impulses, spontaneous, temporal unawareness, random, lack of sequence, No concern about separate parts. Down in the bookstore, we have that book, Intro to Theology. I was kidding my wife. I said, I think you and I should go through that book in our own quiet time together as a couple. We should go through the Intro to Theology. Well, she wasn't excited about that at all. Very nonverbal, associates words by touching object, not by viewing the picture. Diffuses information. All those terms there. Gives you some idea of the differences between left brain and right brain. I want to be quick to say that I'm not saying that women don't enjoy theology. I know some that love it. Well, when you think about learning theory, a little Chinese proverb that sums it up very simply. I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. I do and I understand. What did Jesus say about the commandments? Except ye do. Except ye do. You don't know. Okay? That's how we're wired. I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. Now there's a gentleman, or we don't know anymore if it was a gentleman or a lady, but somebody with the last name of Hogue came up with a little ladder that illustrates this as well. And he demonstrated, he says, how much do students remember after 72 hours of teaching the lesson? Okay, so they were talking 3 days. Okay, so you teach a lesson on one day. How much do they remember about a lesson 72 hours later? Well, it depends on how students engage in the material in the lesson. If you want a copy of this, you can request a copy. This would be the kind of thing you could post on your desk and stimulate your thinking a little bit. He said, well, it depends on how much they engage. If they hear, 72 hours later, they'll remember 5%. If they see, 72 hours later, they'll remember 10%. If they echo, you say it, you say, now, what did I just say? Or how many dogs did I say were in the circle? Okay, they echo. Or if they recite, there we have rote memorization. They recite, memorize. Remember, 25%. Well, we're getting better with rote memorization. If they can discuss it, they'll remember 60%. 72 hours later. If they can work on a project, they'll remember 75 to 80% of it. If you can get them to teach it, they'll remember 95% of it. Now, think about the implications of this just in Bible and in church life. I did a survey in my high school back home. One part of the survey was a number of questions about Sunday school. I just wanted to hear, and the survey wasn't original with me, but it was a well-designed survey. And if you ever get to an ACSI convention or see ACSI published books, this one is entitled something about the next generation. So remember the title. I showed it to some of you this week. Anyway, it has to do with the next generation. And in that book is just a compilation of the results of a survey they did and then some conclusions they draw. But my students, far too many of them had no appreciation or enjoyment whatsoever of Sunday school class in church. And think about a good sermon. If this is really true, well, just ask yourself, how much of last Sunday's sermon do you remember? It is true that we learn things, but doing is far more important. And here again, I think, points up the necessity for every believer to have somebody that they're discipling. You can't fully grow without doing it yourself. If you disciple somebody, you're going to be pushing to learn and figure out why it is you believe what you believe. So discipling is so important. Because it makes you learn. That's because you're doing this up here. And so when you teach Sunday school, when you teach Bible, you sit in church, you need to be asking yourself, how's this going to stick? Because here's the unfortunate thing that happens, and I call it students becoming gospel hard. They go through Sunday school for 18 years of their life, or 16 or whatever. They go through Christian school for 8, 10, 12 years. And they hear stories at home. And if there's no point except you do that, but mom and dad aren't out winning disciples, they're not doing what those stories are talking about. They're just going to church on Sunday, and they're concerned about making money and making ends meet and just keeping the ship floating. There's going to come in a cynicism and a hardening. Just call it gospel hard. And it's a tragedy. We'd be better off not teaching nearly as much Bible. We'd be better off. I'm not saying we shouldn't teach any. We'd be better off. In fact, we were talking to our group here the other day, yesterday maybe it was. What is on the impact of this salvation for children issue? Some of you that are in other countries here working with children that come from non-Christian families. And they were observing that it seemed like teaching Bible all through school, so many of these children would go home and see most of what they heard in school be broken and violated. And if they did not make the choice to become a Christian, it just seemed to harden them. I mean, they knew all the do's and don'ts and whys and wherefores, but if they didn't choose to accept it, it hardened them. And I see some of that same thing happening in my school back home. We heard so much, and yet students just kind of glazed. They didn't see the connection between life and what they were hearing. And that's a tragedy. So keep this in front of you. Let's look at this another way. Now, one more thing on this. Is it possible every math lesson, every grammar lesson, every geography lesson, to get up into the project and teaching the lesson part? No, it's not possible. Not and cover all the material. So what do you do as a teacher? Well, what I want to do is I want to stay uncomfortable with staying down in here. I want to be looking for ways, little ways sometimes, just a little thing. A 5-minute discussion, a 3-minute discussion of something can be that much that a student may hang on to. And that gets them up into this category. Talking, just discussing. And then if you can design one project a semester or a year where you pull some things together, try to determine what is the one or two things I would really, if they forget everything else, what would I want them to remember? And then try to design something around that. It's hard work. And I don't do it perfectly. But it's something I want to keep in front of me. Here's something I got, a chart I got from the local Votech school here in Meadville. And of course, as a vocational school, they're going to be big on experience and learning. And we'll take a break after this chart here. Experience and learning. Here's, this side has to do with our level of involvement. It goes from passive to active. And here we tend to remember 10%, 90%. Here's the continuum. And so they start. 10% of what we read, 20% of what we hear, 30% of what we see. Okay? And notice this is all verbal and visual receiving. It's passive. It's not active. I'm just receiving visually and auditorily. But we remember 50% of what we hear and see. Look at this. Watch a movie. That's why visual media and television have been so powerful in societies, because we see it and hear it. When I was in my college lit class, we watched two movies, one of a Shakespeare play and one of another more contemporary movie, which a book is written on this, Death of a Salesman. No, not the book. It's just a play. Death of a Salesman. It's a commentary on the American dream. Well, I asked my professor, I said, why am I so deeply moved by these? I mean, they made a great impact. And I looked around me, and most of the people didn't seem to be all that, oh, they're watching it, but it was pretty much a ho-hum experience. And they weren't, you know, thrill movies or anything like that. Well, he talked a little bit about a few things. But in thinking and reading more about the effects of TV, I think I know why. For one thing, I hadn't seen very many plays or movies in my life. And so when I experienced something visually and orally, there was something about that interaction there. it pulled in my mind, how I learned, and it pulled in my emotions. And in a sense, I participated in what was happening in those. And so it affected me. The problem is that after a while, if I watched enough, they would affect me less and less and less and less. And that's why in America today, you need more thrillers, better thrillers, to have the same impact. Well, let's move on down. Looking at an exhibit, watching a demonstration, seeing it done on location. Well, we tend to remember 70% of what we say. So if we participate in a discussion, we give a talk. Here we're moving into the active involvement area, receiving and participating. And 90% of what we both say and do. When we say, we hear. When we do, we see. So here we're incorporating the cognitive, affective, and psychomotor domains of learning. When we do a dramatic presentation or simulate the real experience, or we do the real thing. Now, schools of necessity are places where you cannot do the real thing in everything you learn. So here again, we need to be thinking about what is it I actually want the student to go away with? And how am I going to accomplish that, carry it out? When we come back after break, we'll talk about learning disabilities, and I have a number of handouts for you on that, and gifted students, and then we'll talk a little bit about learning styles. So let's go until 20 till 11.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.